This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
For our rendezvous with the dead this week, we'll be spending some time in the company of one of the pantomime villains of Irish history. Sitting at the right hand of Satan is the rack-renting landlord or his obsequious agent. But occupying pride of place on the left of the Prince of Darkness is the informer. Despite the fact that one man's informer is another's source and one man's turncoat is someone else's loyalist, it's hard even to be ambiguous about the renegade spy. Perhaps if they didn't benefit financially from their endeavours, there might be some kudos attached to ratting out your friends and colleagues, but it's rare that an informer would risk his hide merely for the sake of the cause. Professor Tom Bartlett of the School of History and Archives in University College Dublin has made a close study of one of the more odious examples of the turncoat. Professor Bartlett is the author of the highly regarded work The Fall and Rise of the Catholic Nation, The Irish Catholic Question, 1690-1830. He's also co-editor of The Military History of Ireland and is currently working on the Cambridge History of Ireland. He'll be talking about Leonard McNally, a late 18th century celebrity who managed to conceal, until well after his death, the fact that he had betrayed both the United Irishmen in 1798 and Robert Emmet in 1803.
Until his death in 1820, Leonard McNally was known and respected in Dublin as a successful playwright, whose plays had been performed at Covent Garden and Drury Lane, as a prominent barrister whose clients had included the Shears brothers and Robert Emmet, and as an early and leading member of the Society of United Irishmen, which had advocated radical reform in Ireland in the 1790s, and which had then gone on to promote an ill-fated insurrection in 1798. McNally's credentials as a patriot up to the time of his death seemed not only incontestable, but also impeccable. In 1799, he had taken a stand, along with other members of the Irish legal profession, against the proposed Act of Union, and he spoke out against it on occasion after 1800. A Protestant, he had been a prominent supporter of the movement for Catholic emancipation. In 1811, he acted for members of the Catholic Board when they were arrested under the terms of the Convention Act. And he numbered Daniel O'Connell and John Philpot Curran among his friends. A year before he died, he had met John Devereux, like himself a former United Irishman, but now recruiting for Simon Bolivar's Liberation Army in South America. And McNally had presented him with a powerful talisman, nothing less than Lord Edward Fitzgerald's United Irish badge. Soon after, McNally passed away in what was described as the odour of sanctity, hailed in nationalist circles as McNally the Incorruptible. Shortly after his death, it emerged that McNally had been for many years in receipt of a Secret Service pension of £300, bestowed on him as payment for information supplied by him on his friends, colleagues and clients. Sensationally, the man who had been acclaimed by Curran for, quote, his uncompromising and romantic fidelity over many years to Ireland, had turned out to have been for over two decades Dublin Castle's most important paid informer. By interrogating McNally's letters to Dublin Castle over the period 1795 to 1820, can we assess what damage he did to the patriot cause? Equally, can we discover what lay behind his betrayal? Details are sketchy about McNally's early life. He was born in Dublin in 1752 of Catholic stock. His father was a grocer. McNally appears to have converted to the established church in the 1760s. He was entirely self-educated, and in 1774 he entered the Middle Temple in London to study law. In 1776, he was called to the Irish Bar, where he practiced for a time. But money proved elusive, and he returned to London, where he earned his living by journalism and by writing for the stage. In the late 1770s, McNally wrote a series of quite forgettable comedies. But in May 1782, he scored his first clear theatrical success, his Retaliation, or The Citizen a Soldier, a frivolous tale of intrigue, was performed at the Theatre Royal, Covent Garden, and was regularly listed over the following years. A year later, his Tristram Shandy, a sentimental Shandian bagatelle by the author of Retaliation, was produced at the Theatre Royal, and even though the critics were unenthusiastic, the public liked it, and it went on to receive regular productions over the next few years. McNally followed up this success with his most popular theatrical work, Robin Hood, or Sherwood Forest, a comic opera, which was first performed at Covent Garden in April 1784. It attracted large audiences, on three occasions taking in more than £200. However, forsaking his career as a playwright, McNally returned to Dublin in or around 1790, where he began to practice once again at the Irish Bar. He also threw himself into radical politics, signalling his arrival on the scene by writing an address to the Whig Club, in which he called for an end to corruption, denounced the purchased dependence of the British minister, and urged the newspaper press to, quote, drag venal politicians before the people. With sentiments such as these, it's not surprising that he found the mildly reformist stance of the Dublin Whig Club uncongenial, and that he should gravitate immediately towards the more radical Society of United Irishmen when it was set up in Dublin in November 1791. McNally proved an extremely active member of the society, being first noticed by Thomas Collins, a Dublin Castle spy, in December 1791. From then on, Collins recorded him as attending regularly, speaking frequently, and often proposing new members. In June 1792, he was appointed one of the committee, along with William Drennan and Theobald Wolfe Tone, charged with drawing up a congratulatory address to James Napper Tandy on his recent acquittal. In April 1793, McNally showed his commitment to the United Irishmen by fighting a duel with a fellow barrister, Sir Jonah Barrington, who had spoken disparagingly of the Society's members. McNally lost a thumb in this engagement. Again, McNally was one of the select group who drew up the United Irish proposals for parliamentary reform. He was also present at the final open meeting of the Society on 23rd of May 1794. On that date, Dublin Castle, on foot of information received concerning negotiations between a French agent, the Reverend William Jackson, and members of the United Irishmen, issued an order suppressing the Society. With the outbreak of war between Britain and revolutionary France in February 1793, Ireland had once again become an object of French military attention. Early in 1794, Jackson had come to Dublin on behalf of the French Revolutionary Government to investigate the likely reaction in Ireland to the arrival of a French force. Unfortunately for Jackson, from an early date he had been placed under British government surveillance. In particular, he had been accompanied to Ireland by John Cockayne, a London solicitor who was employed as an informer by William Pitt, the Prime Minister. It appears that both Cockayne and Jackson had known McNally in London, and they made him their first port of call in Dublin. McNally offered them dinner and facilitated contacts with known radicals, including Archibald Hamilton Rowan, then in Newgate Prison, and Theobald Wolfe Tone. When the British government in Dublin Castle had intercepted sufficient incriminating material concerning Jackson, he was seized and put on trial, charged with high treason. Those who had been in contact with him were closely questioned. Hamilton Rowan acknowledged his guilt by escaping from jail and fleeing the country. Theobald Wolfe Tone, as well, conceded the strength of the case against him by undertaking to go into permanent exile in order to avoid prosecution. McNally was almost certainly interrogated, but curiously, there was no immediate threat of legal action against him. It was, it seems, sometime after the arrest of Jackson in late April 1794 that McNally embarked on his career as a government informer. The timing of McNally's decision to turn informer appears to point at least to one of his motives, self-preservation. McNally had been gravely compromised by his association with Jackson, and there was every chance that he would be taken into custody. Even if he were not charged, for a rising barrister to be so closely identified with the Revolutionary Party in Ireland would mean inevitably that, whatever the outcome, his professional career would be damaged, perhaps irreparably. Did McNally turn informer in order to head off a crippling prosecution? It certainly seems probable that McNally, confronted by evidence of his complicity with Jackson, was induced to turn informer, and it seems likely that it was John Pollock, Clerk of the Crown on the Leinster Circuit and attorney to the Marquess of Downshire, who turned him and arranged payment for him. Now, in any discussion of the motivation of an informer, it is inevitable that the question of financial reward will be raised, and there is no doubt that McNally was persistent, some might say insatiable, in his demands for money. In September 1795, he tactfully reminded his handler of, quote, a private subject respecting myself, and requested prompt action. By July 1796, he had abandoned delicacy and was even prepared to allow money to be sent directly to his home in Dominic Street. By January 1798, he had grown both desperate and piteous in his demands. "I am in deep distress for want of money. Neglect to me is cruelty." In the event, it was not until June 1801 that McNally was awarded a secret pension of £300 per annum. Until that date, he had to be content with amounts of between £50 and £100 doled out periodically through Pollock's agency. Such sums can scarcely be regarded as extravagant, and financial inducement can scarcely have been the sole motive for McNally's betrayals. For if money had been his god, then he ought to have abandoned radical politics, because his association with the United Irishmen was gravely damaging his legal career. Such a withdrawal was in fact feasible. William Drennan, one of the founders of the United Irishmen, had backed away from the society after 1795 and, after a lean period, had pursued a successful career as an accoucheur or lying-in doctor. Again, Peter Burroughs, a lawyer and friend of Tone, forsook his flirtation with radical politics and made a successful legal career. And John Keogh, the Catholic activist, also distanced himself from his former friends after 1795. Perhaps McNally could not, in fact, escape. Once bought, he had no option but to stay bought. Yet there is no indication in any of the 160 or so extant letters from McNally over the period 1795 to 1818 that he regretted his clandestine activities or that he sought a way out. On the contrary, as the years passed, he evidently warmed to his role as an informer. In addition, as ostensibly an open and avowed supporter of the United Irishmen, McNally ran no small risk from the depredations of Crown forces in the period of the rebellion. It has been argued, I think well, that, quote, "McNally lost much more by his politics than he ever gained from the government. Had his politics from the beginning been of a different type, his professional talents would probably have raised him to the bench." McNally's persistent demands for payment from the castle have to be viewed in this light. He was a talented, if overly dramatic, barrister, and he was a legal scholar with, by the early 1800s, several notable publications to his name. He could legitimately have expected to make his career and his fortune at the Irish bar. Instead, he ended up, as William Drennan sniffed, a sort of Newgate solicitor, much looked down upon by the bar, a notorious United Irishman. McNally gave up career expectations, and he forfeited much peace of mind in return for an annual stipend so meagre that when it ceased on his death, its absence plunged his family and dependents, eight and all, into penury. What was his motivation? It is possible that principle played some part in McNally's desertion of the United Irishmen. There is no sign that he ever harboured revolutionary or separatist notions. And another informer noted McNally's unease in 1793 at the increasingly subversive tone of discussions among the United Irishmen. For McNally, the Jackson mission may have proved the last straw. Moreover, McNally's confidential position with the castle gave him the opportunity to voice with impunity trenchant criticisms of the government's security policy and of the army's activities. There was no holding back in McNally's letters, and to that extent he retained his earlier radicalism. He pointed out the folly of treating suspects in a cruel manner. He condemned the ghoulish practice of displaying rebel heads on spikes. And he was wholly opposed to the judiciary's policy of exemplary justice. Secure in the belief that he had the ear of the Chief Secretary and Lord Lieutenant, McNally no doubt flattered himself that his strictures on the forces of law and order were being duly noted and even acted upon. In his own lights, he was acting as a patriot. Perhaps he justified to himself his betrayals in this way. Perhaps he believed that if he could help prevent an insurrection, then he would have done no small service to his country. But there was, inevitably, a very dark side to McNally's treachery, one which cannot be overlooked in any discussion of his possible principles. In his brilliant study of the 16th century secret agent Giordano Bruno, John Bossi remarks that the act of informing, quote, "contrary to an impression which has been put around, always involves betraying your friends or people you have caused to believe your friends. McNally's basest betrayals involve those of his clients who knew him and trusted him and who were at their most vulnerable, men charged with high treason on trial for their lives. He betrayed the secrets and defence strategies of William Jackson, John and Henry Shears, Robert Emmet, who all paid with their lives, and many others now mostly forgotten. He handed over to the castle Jackson's last letters to his wife. He held back Robert Emmet's to his brother. He alerted the prosecution at the Maidstone treason trials in early 1798 as to the general thrust of what the Irish defence witnesses would say. A few months later, he urged the Shears brothers to stand their trial together, even though the guilt of one would surely seal the fate of the other. Again, when the veracity of the principal prosecution witness against the Shears brothers, Captain Armstrong, was called into question by Armstrong's former commanding officer, who said, quote, "I would not pay much attention to what he said, nor give much credit even to his oath," McNally withheld this potentially embarrassing letter from the defence counsel, i.e., he withheld it from himself. Even in relatively minor cases, McNally appears routinely to have disclosed defence strategy to the prosecution, and he certainly reported his conversations with his clients. All in all, it is difficult to square such treachery and betrayal with any recognised definition of principle. Could it be that it was the element of risk in informing that attracted McNally to informing and that led him to persist in it? He was, after all, a notorious duelist who had lost a thumb in one encounter and who walked with a pronounced limp after another. No stranger to danger, he may have relished the perilous situations in which he inevitably found himself. As an avowed United Irishman, he was always liable to arrest and worse in the late 1790s, and there was always the possibility of discovery by his supposed colleagues, his hitherto unsuspecting United Irish friends. McNally well knew that the offices of Dublin Castle were insecure. He even claimed that the United Irishmen had penetrated the Irish post office, and he understood, therefore, that the chance of being unmasked as an informer was always high. Was this part of the thrill? But we cannot suggest that McNally was reckless in his behaviour, deliberately courting danger. On the contrary, he took every precaution to shield his identity and protect his activities. He burned all communications from the castle. He rarely used a courier. He had adopted the initials JW as his signature, almost never employed any kind of salutation, and sometimes disguised his handwriting. He always referred to himself as my friend, our friend, or simply as McNally. It would have been difficult to deduce that McNally was himself the author of those letters which were delivered to Dublin Castle from 1795 on. And of course, the very fact that he operated entirely undetected for nearly 25 years shows that whatever secret excitement he derived from his dangerous work must have been restrained by cold calculation and tempered by the need for self-preservation. Lastly, in terms of motivation, in the light of what we know of McNally's later career as a paid informer, does a scrutiny of his creative writing during the 1780s offer any hint of what was to come, or hold out any clue as to his motivation for subsequent betrayal of his associates and clients? In his brief discussion of McNally, W.E.H. Leckie concluded that he was, quote, "a strangely composite character in whom were combined singularity and melancholia." The literary or theatrical tone to Leckie's description is apt, for McNally can be read as a character in a novel or as an actor in a play, as well as a figure on the historical stage. On several occasions, he referred to the character I assume or the part I have taken, and it was vital for him to play his public role as agitator to perfection. McNally would have been delighted at the way he was frequently denounced to Dublin Castle, for it offered proof that he was staying in character. The shock and disbelief that greeted disclosure of his long-standing private deception can only be understood by reference to the complete success of McNally's long-running public performance. It is, however, McNally's secret role over the years that concerns us. Was this prefigured in his theatrical or prose writings? Given that so many of McNally's popular works for the theatre, Robin Hood, Retaliation, Fashionable Levities, all involve some measure of deception, deceit, and disguise, it's tempting to see in them ominous signposts to his future career in subterfuge. A recurrent theme in McNally's plays is that no one is who or what they quite seem to be. And yet, the temptation to read McNally's plays, with perhaps one exception, as indicators of his future duplicitous role ought to be resisted. So very many plays at that time and since have hinged on disguise or deception that no conclusions can be drawn. The possible exception to this statement is McNally's Tristram Shandy, A Sentimental Shandian Bagatelle, a work which, with his prose work Sentimental Excursions to Windsor, is possibly worth further consideration. McNally was much taken with Laurence Sterne's novel or anti-novel Tristram Shandy and by Sterne's other prose writings. He adapted the novel for the London stage and he published a parody on Sterne's Sentimental Journey. Just as Sterne was consciously subversive of all literary conventions, perhaps McNally relished flouting other codes of conduct by informing on his companions and clients. To do so by writing would surely have added to the enjoyment. After one interminable digression in Tristram Shandy, the narrator bursts out, "But this is neither here nor there. Why do I mention it? Ask my pen. It governs me. I govern not it." McNally, ever prolix, might have agreed. In his note recommending McNally for a pension of £300 per annum, Edward Cook, Undersecretary, commented that he was, quote, "not much trusted, but I believe he has been useful." Too much should not be made of Cook's apparent faint praise for McNally's services. Useful carried a much higher approval rating in the 18th century than it does today. McNally's clandestine services to government lay in a variety of areas. We have already noted his practice of divulging the defences of his clients to the prosecution and his propensity for lengthy depictions on the public mood in the late 1790s. Little more needs to be said on these points. McNally had excellent contacts with some of the leading Catholic activists, and through them he could keep the castle informed on their thinking and plans. His earliest letters date from February-March 1795, a time when Catholic hopes of full emancipation had been dashed by the abrupt recall of the Lord Lieutenant Earl Fitzwilliam. Dublin Castle and London were most anxious to learn how Irish Catholics would react to this crushing setback, and McNally duly obliged. McNally's letters on Catholic attitudes ended up, after several copies, in Prime Minister William Pitt's postbag, an indication, surely, of the value attached to them. Again, some years later, McNally described in detail the reaction of Catholic lay people to this proposed union with Great Britain. And after the union, he supplied the castle with intelligence on the Catholic question. At least two chief secretaries, Sir Arthur Wellesley in 1807 and William Wesley Pole in 1811, received communications from J.W. on this perennial issue. It was, however, McNally's constant information on the plans and activities of the United Irishmen which most impressed Dublin Castle, and which today elicits a whistle of appreciation from historians. On the face of it, McNally was ideally placed to supply vital intelligence. As a senior member of the United Irishmen, though never one involved in military activity, he was in constant contact with leading figures within the revolutionary movement, and he was privy to some of their secrets. Moving easily within their social circle, McNally was in a position to report on the absence or arrival of key players, on journeys which they had undertaken, on the gossip which was inevitably circulating among them, and on their personal rivalries. Dublin Castle presumably found such low-grade information valuable in attempting to build up a picture of the nature and extent of the threat that confronted it. Crucially, in the eyes of Dublin Castle, McNally was on intimate terms with James Tandy, son of James Napper Tandy. Now, the son, James Tandy, was no revolutionary, but his father, a long-time radical, was very active in the conspiracy, having fled from Ireland in 1795. Throughout this period, and for some years after the rebellion, Napper Tandy kept in touch with his son, who, for his part, saw no harm in showing his father's letters to another long-term radical and James's own confidential friend, Leonard McNally, who in his turn passed on the contents to Dublin Castle. On the face of it, then, it would appear that McNally played a major role in the castle's secret war, particularly in the years before the rebellion. Camden and Cook in Dublin, Pelham and Portland in London, all accepted him as an authority on the United Irish conspirators, and their letters have numerous references to information provided by him. And yet, can we accept without question their estimation of his worth? McNally's prime source, the letters of Napper Tandy, are undoubtedly interesting. But their author was emphatically not the leading conspirator that the castle believed him to be. Napper Tandy, was poorly informed on French intentions, and lacking any detailed knowledge of affairs in Ireland, he succeeded only in sowing confusion, confusion and spreading disinformation among the United Irishmen and in misleading Dublin Castle. Napper-Tandy, in short, was impossible. Eventually, after the rebellion, even Dublin Castle came to see that he was not the threat they had once imagined. Furthermore, it should be noted that while Tandy's highly suspect information, transmitted via McNally, was eagerly accepted by Dublin Castle, significant intelligence also provided by McNally was sometimes ignored. For example, from an early date, McNally was aware of the abilities and determination of Theobald Wolfe Tone. And in September 1795, he forecast that he would not be surprised to hear of Tone shortly being at Paris. Again, it was McNally who broke the news to the castle that Tone had in fact been in Paris for some time and that he had played a key role in organising the French invasion of Ireland, and that his early memoranda on Ireland constituted the groundwork of all subsequent negotiations, as he put it, between the French and the United Irishmen. McNally also revealed that Tone had been actually on board one of the ships on the expedition to Bantry Bay. Notwithstanding such reports, no particular attention was paid to Theobald Wolfe Tone. Dublin Castle remained firm in its belief that Napper-Tandy was central to the conspiracy and that Tone was not. As a result, the castle seriously underestimated Tone's role in the revolutionary decade. Perhaps, in short, a more modest assessment of McNally's contribution to the secret war of the 1790s and perhaps of the effects of his treachery would therefore appear to be in order. McNally died on the 13th of February 1820. As the informer, J.W., he had once unblushingly declared that it was very probable that the famous anti-revolutionary Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, John Thomas Troy, was up, that is, a sworn and secret United Irishman. He had claimed several times that the local Dominican priests, his neighbours in Dominic Street, were the principal agents for disseminating sedition and disaffection. He had revealed the plans of Catholic activists for more than 20 years, and he had been a professed Protestant all his life. But on his deathbed, McNally sent for a Catholic priest, the final betrayal. Thank you very much.
Professor Tom Bartlett on Leonard McNally, playwright, barrister, United Irishman and informer. Next week on Speaking Ill of the Dead, Professor Paul Bew will be looking at the negative legacy of one of the few 19th century British politicians who usually gets a good press in Ireland, the great Liberal Prime Minister, William Gladstone.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.